Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. We're having our walk in the hills again today, seeing as the weather's so nice. Today we're going to do something that we haven't done before, where we're going to be doing the next chapter of the Lao Tzu series. But we recorded it yesterday, but then we had a long discussion about how odd it was and how, to me, it seemed quite... Either Lao Tzu was really having an off day, or someone else wrote it, or the translation was terrible, and it just didn't seem quite right. So what we did was we went and had a look at some other translations to see if there was a major difference, and there actually is quite a big difference. So today we're going to compare three translations of the same chapter. So we're going to start off by reading out the three, and then. And talking about the differences in the wording and what we think he was trying to get at. All right, so we'll start off. We'll read the from the book that we normally read from. Okay, so here's this first one.
Yeah, it's by the way, this is episode 23 in our series.
Yeah,
and if you haven't listened to the others, I do advise going back. They're very good.
Yeah.
In fact, just go back and have a little look around. We've got hundreds of podcasts. I think it's over 200 now.
Yeah, there's loads of material in the catalogue.
Okay, this is Lao Tzu 23. In other words, that means the 23rd episode of our Lao Tzu series. And this is chapter 36 in the edition that we've been using up until now. What is going to be diminished must first be allowed to inflate. Whatever you want to weaken must first be convinced of its strength. What you want to overcome, you must first of all submit to. What you want to take over, you must first of all give to. This is called discerning. You see, what is yielding and weak overcomes what is hard and strong. And just as a fish can't be seen when he stays down in the deep, don't show your power to anyone.
Okay then, so here we have the second version.
Yeah, okay, this is from a very popular translation by Jia Fu Feng and Jane English. Came out in 1973. And so it's very popular, you'll find this on many bookshelves. Chapter 36 again. That which shrinks must first expand. That which fails must first be strong. That which is cast down must first be raised. Before receiving, there must be giving. This is called perception of the nature of things. Soft and weak overcome hard and strong. Fish cannot leave deep waters, and a country's weapons should not be displayed.
We're definitely seeing a bit of the difference in that one. Then,
okay, this is another version, and this is a translation by Victor H. Meyer. It hasn't been out that long, and it's purportedly a translation of a newly discovered manuscript. And Meyer is quite a scholar of Taoism and ancient Chinese literature, and. He thinks this is the most authentic Tao Te Ching. But the chapters are in a different order from the ones that we usually get. And the one that we're dealing with in this edition comes in at number 80. And Meyer does give us the traditional order in brackets underneath. So it's 36 in the traditional, as we've just seen, and number 80 in this version, which is actually the last but one chapter. When you wish to contract something, you must momentarily expand it. When you wish to weaken something, you must momentarily strengthen it. When you wish to reject something, you must momentarily join with it. When you wish to seize something, you must momentarily give it up. This is called subtle insight. The soft and weak conquer the strong. Fish cannot be removed from the watery depths. The profitable instruments of state cannot be shown to the people.
So let's start off looking at the first couple of lines of all of them, which are quite similar, I think.
Yeah. That which shrinks must first expand, or what is going to be diminished must be first allowed to inflate. When you wish to contract something, you must momentarily expand it. You've got the central Taoist idea there of the mutual dependence of opposites in a dynamic interrelationship. It's not the mutual dependence of opposites as though they were static things, but it captures the movement and the dynamic of things in that first thing. If you've got expansion, there has to be contraction. And it sounds though as though Lao Tzu's been quite Machiavellian, that he's giving us some strategies for manipulation of other people. Now, it seems to me that this, whichever of these translations that we look at, that this chapter is about statecraft primarily. But it's also about outlining a very general principle that goes beyond statecraft and applies to what you might call ordinary individuals, and that it can offer them a strategy for dealing with the conflictual aspects of life. It also strikes me that this general principle can apply to meditation, to the events that we find when we go quietly inside ourselves and allow ourselves to see what is going on there. And I think the general principle is this, and I'm going to use the Maya translation. The soft and weak conquer the strong. Remember, he's offering this as a strategy. In all three versions, there's a strategic feel. In the other ones, what does it say? You see, what is yielding and weak overcomes what is hard and strong. What else does he say? Soft and weak overcome hard and strong. And this, he's offering this as a principle of statecraft. You know, meeting force with force. That the superior force will prevail, usually, unless you make a mistake and trip over yourself. And for most people, it's not the best option. But there are ways of being weak in a situation which allow you to overcome. And you've got this principle gets applied in martial arts, the idea that you sidestep, stick your foot out and the guy trips over you. And the more forcefully he's hurtling at you, the more his own force ends up injuring him himself. So there's the idea of applying that to statecraft. Because remember the previous chapter is about the nature of the sage, and then he follows on with this as though it was an expansion on the ideas put forward in the previous chapter about this kind of low-key yielding modest nature which is thought to be ideal for a sagacious ruler. Now what troubled us yesterday about this was that it made Lao Tzu seem sort of quite Machiavellian, quite ruthlessly manipulative in order to win. And we've kind of liked to think of him as a bit of a nice guy, really. But he does look a bit Machiavellian here, and every one of these translations at some point sort of seems to indicate that. I mean, for instance, a country's weapons should not be displayed. And you can see as a strategy, if you've got enemies and they are arming themselves the teeth ready to come for you, it's a good idea for them not to know what resources you have at your disposal. It'll cause them to miscalculate. It'll cause uncertainty. But this is very definitely strategic, you know. And in the Maya version, the profitable instruments of state cannot be shown to the people. This is a bit like Plato's guardians, you know, and philosopher kings, keeping the people in the dark. Plato in the Republic. Whether Plato himself thinks this is another matter, but he puts forward the idea that a good state's very secretive and just keeps people in the dark. In fact, to the point of telling what he calls noble lies. And of course, this is a tradition that we're kind of living with, except the lies are not very noble. In fact, I think the whole idea of noble lies is complete and absolute corruption, ultimately. And you don't really want to live in a state of darkness. Even though some people seem to be fairly content with that for some reason.
Yeah.
So that's what made it problematic for us, was that. And but of course, Lao Tzu's writing in the time of the Warring States. He is offering advice to would-be leaders before he buggers off up the mountain to be a hippie and mind his own business.
But we've got a line here that we can compare very strongly in each one, because in each one, after he's talked about what's going to be diminished must first be allowed to inflate and that sort of part of it. Every single one of these translations has the line which stands alone, saying this is called, all of them.
Yeah.
And in the first one it says this is called discerning, and the second one we read out says this is called perception of the nature of things, and in the third one it says this is called subtle insight. Which I found quite interesting how they were very comparable, because they all say this is called.
What this is doing, it's relating strategy, statecraft, rulership, or individual strategy for living in conflictual times, to insight, or to some kind of way of seeing things which is subtle or discerning and out of the ordinary in some way, in as much as it delivers more information. In fact, it delivers some very fundamental information about the nature of things. And what, of course, it's delivering is the idea that opposites are completely mutually dependent, as per Western alchemy, but also always in a dynamic relationship. And that knowledge of this can become the core of any strategy for living, or any strategy for encountering yourself, your humanity, in meditation. And it seems to me that this is identical to Viveka, which is described and given as both an attribute and a practice of meditation by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra. Viveka, discriminative awareness. And how this works is that if one is quiet, if one allows oneself to be quiet, bearing in mind you can't force yourself to be quiet, but you can allow yourself to be quiet, that the organism, the human organism, becomes more sensitive. A lot more sensitive. The senses become more acute. The brain becomes clearer when it comes to matters of thinking through things. And then one becomes aware of subtle distinctions and subtle mechanisms and subtle movements in the world, in the psyche, in nature, in human matters like combat, conflict, statecraft, and just ordinary personal living. These subtle discernments, these subtle insights, are not readily observable in the ordinary course of things, because we have too much clutter and clatter. We have to do stuff. We have to come and share the sheep.
Fine, by the way, it's just having a moan.
Yeah, we have to go to the post office. We have to worry about our tax. We have to nurture our relationships. It's just like endless tasks of life. Just cluttering up and making this kind of clamour and clatter and clutter in our brains and in our organisms, which desensitise us so that we don't become aware of these subtler aspects of the nature of things. And therefore, we don't have that knowledge at our disposal when we are forced willy-nilly to strategize in life. And of course, rulers have to strategize in life, in their role as rulers. And you know, Lao Tzu is always about the politics. He's always about the ruler, but he's always about the meditation. There's always this connection between the character and the being of a would-be ruler and the actual acts of ruling, the actual acts of statecraft, the actual involvement of politics for Lao Tzu. I think that's just that in itself is important. So that's what I see going on here, and I think the different translations, it's interesting, because they are, in a sense, you know, quite a lot different. And yet at the same time, you know, you can discern, if you have a discriminative awareness or a discerning awareness or a subtle insight, you can discern that there is some root meaning underneath this thing. But I mean, we did mention the problem of translation at the very beginning when we set out on this, and I made the point that, well, I'm not a scholar of ancient Chinese, I'm not a scholar of Taoism, and as a philosopher, we're kind of awkward customers who reserve the right to speculate and do our own thing, to use our philosophical imagination. And I made it sort of quite clear at the outset that I'm allowing these translations, these texts, to stimulate me, not slavishly following them. They're acting as stimuli for my imagination. And we make no apology for that. You know, philosophers, we do that. We're bastards. We do it. You know, and I think what is important there is that you're clear about it. You're clear about it. And for my own part, I've made it fairly clear that I use all kinds of material quite willy-nilly, and perhaps disrespectfully, you might even say, but with a view to offering some formulations and some stimuli of my own that might be useful to somebody out there. So that's what's going on here. This isn't scholarship. It's philosophy with the aim of having some real use to some other human beings, which may or may not happen. One hopes.
One hopes.
But maybe one hopes against hope. Okay, so
maybe not. This line here, I think the last part of each one, yeah. They all mention fish. So in the first one, and just as the fish can't be seen when he stays down in the deep, don't show your power to anyone. So that says you. Says don't show your power to anyone. And then in the second one, fish cannot leave deep waters, and a country's weapons should not be displayed.
Yeah.
And then in the third one, we've got fish cannot be removed from the watery depths. The profitable instruments of state cannot be shown to the people.
Well, it's a strategy of secrecy, of hiding your weapons, as it were, or your capabilities. Remember, in the warring states, if you were the leader of a state, one of the best things you do would be to keep your opponents, and there were many, you were surrounded with them, to keep them secret. And as I said, the chapter, as well as being about statecraft, though, it's also about meditation. It's also about how more humble individuals might need to strategize in life, especially in hard times. You know, when people have to strategize to stay alive. And as a general rule, keep your powder dry, and don't go out sticking your chest out and beating your breast and saying,
just inviting trouble.
And I'll fight any man in the pub. He's just saying, don't do that. It's just daft.
Yeah.
You know, we want to survive, first of all. It's also as an advice to rulers, and we've said this before, that we live in a time of the delusion of the strong man. When people get sort of particularly desperate, so you've got famine or economic collapse or endless war or environmental degradation, and people start feeling en masse, start feeling insecure, they tend to put forward strong men as their leaders. Or actually, somebody who can give the impression of being a strong man.
Yeah, which is kind of what's happening now, isn't it?
Yeah, and we live
just the illusion of being a strong
man. Yeah, we live in the age of inverted commas strong men. And I dare say there was plenty of this around in the time of the war in States. Now you could almost guarantee. Let's just say no, not intelligent. You know, you want a sagacious ruler, not a breast-beating beating actor.
Yeah.
But people do fall for this time and time again. And you might want to wonder about the psychology of that. And I think there is a need for authority that rises up en masse when people are feeling particularly insecure and scared. That's what they do. They fall into the arms of daddy, basically, don't they? And this is why, Mussolini, you know, was the paradigm case of this. And Hitler, of course, but you know, Trump pretends to be a strong man. Bolsonaro pretends to be a strong man. This is, by the way, one of the core mechanisms of fascism.
Yeah.
So Lao Tzu is saying, well, okay, we need leaders, but let's have sagacious leaders. And if they kind of beat their chest and don't hide their weapons and don't hide their power and don't behave modestly, that they're probably a bad bet.
Yeah, so on Twitter all the time, every day, bragging about how great they are. Probably not so good.
No. Well, that is the kind of noise and clutter that prevents the sensitivity from developing, which then eventually in time becomes viveka, or this acute awareness of the subtle nature of things and the play of forces and the dependence of opposites, of expansion coming before contraction. And so forth, you know, and of like an apparent increase in strength going before the fall, as you might say. So, the kind of in amongst our kind of suspicions that he's been a bit Machiavellian, contextualised into the war in States, understood as being about statecraft, you can kind of get a bit of a handle on it. And if you realise that there is, again, as always in Lao Tzu, a connection between meditation, meditative insight, and politics, and personal politics, as well as collective politics, that you can figure out what's going on here. And it becomes a bit less perplexing than we first found it.
Mm. So a bit of a tricky one today. I mean, this is like the second time we've recorded it. Probably the fourth conversation we've had about this particular one. So hopefully the next one would be slightly easier access. I think Lao Tzu wanted to really test us with this one. Anyway, I hope you found that interesting. I'm going to continue our walk through the hills. Wish you were here because it's a really lovely day. Sorry about all the noise at the beginning. We were going past quite a noisy stream because there's been a lot of rain recently. So there's a lot of gushing water, in case you were wondering what that strange noise was. Anyway, we'll speak to you soon, guys.
Over and out. Lots of love. Wash your hands. Dabochi.